join us in coffee, right?
Start our
Hi, Tammy. Hi, John.
Okay, are we
good? How are you?
We start? Okay. Good afternoon, Westchester. It is Tuesday, the 21st of June. We are the Housing Planning and Operations Committee. We are here in a functional forum in the presence of Legislator Harkin, Legislator Rogowski, Legislator Spreckman, and myself. We have two items to discuss today, the first of which is the item introduced by Legislator Harkin and myself on surplus vehicle transfers. If you'll look in your packet, you will find that you have a draft law, and it's my understanding that we have the environmental impact statement, but that we do not have. Am I correct about this, Debbie? That you do not have the fiscal impact. Is that correct?
I can.
Okay. You'll tell.
Information on that. It was requested. I spoke with Claudia Maxwell in planning, and she indicated it would be a type 2, but she'll provide the appropriate documentation shortly.
Okay. So it would be a type 2, which is not going to cause us any troubles under any circumstances. Okay. Do members have the bill? It's at the top of the pile if it's like mine, but in the fourth line down of the first page it begins defined below in order to more timely assist municipalities. The fourth line, modify the procedure for disposal of certain surplus property. So you have certain surplus property. You got there, Brace. Okay. To bounce past this to Legislator Harkin, who has been championing this matter, and for the folks at home, I'm going to ask him that he give us an overview of what we've been doing here, and then we'll get right into the substance. So, Legislator Harkin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Welcome, everyone. Thank you. We've had a number of discussions on this about what the logistics should be of this. There's agreement with both the legislature and the administration and the commissioner that this is a good thing to move forward with. It had sort of bogged down many years ago because the old procedure needed IMAs with each municipality. It was very unwieldy for the law department, for the legislature, for the administration. So what we decided was to go back to a dollar system for part of the law, but do it in sort of a lottery fashion. And change the law so that the commissioner would have the right to dispose of surplus property. That was one aspect, and that's what is reflected in this law in front of us. There is another aspect that we had discussed, if I may ask a question at this time, that I don't necessarily see in here. I think we had discussed, and George, correct me if I'm wrong, there were other types of vehicles that were not shuttle buses or paratransit that, you know, let's say a pickup truck,
sure,
that someone may have an interest in, and I thought we had agreed that we were going to put those out to auction, see what the price we could get, and then give a municipality right of first refusal.
Right.
Is that what's reflected in paragraph 3?
No, that's not. I wasn't involved with the discussion, but when the idea was presented to me and I reviewed it for purposes of legality and stuff, we thought it was somewhat of a test bid situation, which we're not able to do under the law. You can't put something out to bid, see what it's going to be, and then turn around and sell it for that.
Okay.
So legally, we steered away from that, and we've just tried to streamline this for the paratransit shuttle vehicles and through the lottery dollar system.
Okay. All right. So then I guess that's the question. This certainly, at least to me, seems to adequately address that, and I'm glad you added the shuttle buses.
Sure.
I guess the strategic question is, do we want to pass this to get this passed and start getting the vehicles flowing, or do we still want to roll up our sleeves and see if we can figure out a way to deal with those other vehicles? I guess municipalities can participate on eBay the way we do anyhow.
One of the concerns the administration had was that actually we generate approximately $800,000 in sale of equipment, trucks, and other vehicles that we dispose of. And quite frankly, that's a revenue to my budget.
Right.
So the issue of losing that potential revenue, though the buses derived a very small amount monetarily.
Right.
On the bid process, they were averaging about 1,600 vehicles, as opposed to some of these other pieces of equipment that you get 5,000, 6,000, 7,000, 10,000 depending on the condition.
Right. And that's why we're trying to find a way to get you that revenue.
Sure.
But still
so
give the
right. Right. So I guess the issue of whether we can actually get a low bid and offer to someone else to match it, I guess it's a legal issue, which laws basically said it's not.
Right, that we can't do. Okay. All right, well, that kind of answers that question.
So is your feeling at this time that we have a complete piece of legislation as far as the text is concerned?
Yeah, I think so. I think it would be helpful maybe if Tammy could just take the committee through it very briefly so people know what they would be voting on. The one thing I would suggest just for the committee report, the legislation reflects the inclusion of the shuttle buses. I don't see it in the committee report, but that's a very easy fix.
Well, it's actually in the second paragraph.
Okay.
It's about halfway down, says with the paratransit surplus or obsolete paratransit / shuttle type buses. And then it's a definitional term, paratransit buses. So the reason we did that, I did
it. Oh, I see it there. Okay.
Yeah. And then the reason I defined it as paratransit was so that it wouldn't be confused with any other buses that the county has under the Liberty Lines situation. But it was defined up there, and then it carries through the committee report.
Gotcha.
And the
okay.
same definition appears in the law. Do you want me to take you through the committee report or just the laws themselves?
Let's do both. For purposes of those who are scoring at home, if you could both introduce yourselves to the television. We have four monitors all over the place and people are watching.
John Hsu, Public Works.
Tammy Altshuler, Law Department.
Thank you, Ms. Altshuler. If you could then go ahead.
No problem. Okay, so the committee report is basically gives you a synopsis of what we're doing on the first page and what we're modifying. And we're modifying the general procedures for the sale and lease of surplus property, which is under the laws of Westchester County, and adding a new section to the laws of Westchester County that gives the ability to the commissioner to transfer any of the surplus or obsolete paratransit or shuttle type buses. That's the first page. And then there's some history filtered into here, you know, why we're auctioning them off this way instead of other ways. But the local law proposes that the DPWT commissioner transfers title to these buses to municipalities for a sum of a dollar. Just scanning through the committee report itself.
And I think if I'm not mistaken, in definition of municipalities, you also include school districts, fire districts, those things?
Yes.
Okay, perfect. Thank you.
The definition is in conjunction with what the New York General Municipal Law provides, section 119N, which is a city, town, village, board of cooperative educational services, fire district, or school district.
Great. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
On the third page of the committee report, there's a synopsis of what the lottery system is going to be, and it's anticipated it would be once a year, but it gives discretion to the commissioner if it needs to be more than one time a year. It notes that these vehicles will be transferred in as is conditioned. The next page of the committee report it's more or less, you know, giving you the legalese of the committee report, but it's what your committee's been advised of and what the laws of Westchester currently provide and what we're trying to do, and it goes over what the seeker is going to be, the act is going to constitute a type 2 action. And there's also a piece here about the New York State Municipal Home Rule Law and how this requires a permissive referendum because it's changing one of the laws of Westchester County that disposes of property. So this law will, before it can become effective, has to remain open for 60 days. Okay. And then you'll note the next page, there's a resolution to designate the date for a public hearing because this is a local law. And then we have the local law itself. The first part of the local law is amending chapter 836, section 836.31. And it's basically, these are the laws that deal with the surplus or obsolete supplies and materials and equipment of the county and its disposal. And we're adding into this law that there's going to be an exception for surplus or obsolete paratransit shuttle type buses from this law because we're dealing with it in a different fashion. On the next page, we actually amend the section 131.41. Which will create a section for surplus or obsolete paratransit and shuttle type buses. This is the section of the charter, the chapter of the charter that covers the Department of Public Works and Transportation. In this particular section, you have a definition of what a paratransit bus is, which is the paratransit and shuttle type buses. You have the definition of what a municipal corporation is, which is what I said a few moments ago. city, town, village, board of cooperative educational services, fire district or school district. And then it basically spells out what the Commissioner of Public Works and Transportation will do with regard to the lottery system and how vehicles will be given, and how municipalities will be given an opportunity to look at the vehicles. And that's all spelled out in this particular law. And the second page, sections 4, 5, 6, and 7 each are specifics to how we are going to go about the lottery and the terms and conditions for a transfer of a vehicle under these laws. The section 4 of the local law is again the municipal home rule section, which discusses how we have to keep this open for 60 days, and then that's it.
Well, that was concise.
Pretty concise?
Good. Comments by members of the committee. Mr. Rogowski.
Well, Mr. Chairman, thank you. I guess I would start. One might argue that this is the Housing Committee doing this legislation. I think I would be interested in knowing if the Legislation Committee was doing this legislation.
It goes to legislation.
This will go to legislation?
Yeah.
Okay, well,
yeah.
Good, because...
This is the operations part.
I see. Well, no, and I agree. I mean, everything is fine, but it's just a legal question that maybe the Legislation Committee might take on is, could all of this, and set forth, especially the new section, could we simply do this by requiring the commissioner to set up regulations to accomplish this? I mean, there's a lot of stuff in here, and I support it all, but I mean, as an alternative way, it's all laid out, we certainly can pass it as is, but it's just as a question of an alternative way to accomplish this goal was, instead of putting all this detail in the charter, by simply setting out some parameters and having the commissioner do it. But it's just a comment as to procedure of doing that. The Legislation Committee can look at that. But I specific on page, paragraph 4 of 131.4.1, where it starts with, it's anticipated the county will hold the lottery once a year. The very last sentence of just, I know what we mean to say where corporations that receive a bus are not eligible to participate in the lottery, I might say again, but the question I have is, until all the corporations have had the option to participate and have indicated no interest, one could argue that the very next time the county goes to advertise, mm-hmm. It's an interpretation. Presumably, everybody is going to have an opportunity.
Yes.
So the interpretation of that is, the next lottery
The way I interpret that is that if I go out on, let's say I have 6 vehicles available, I post it. 2 takers, they give reasons, we give them 2 vehicles, we auction off the other 4. 6 months from now, I have 6 more vehicles come online. It goes on an RFP basis, we solicit. And if the same 2 municipalities are seeking additional vehicles and no one else applies, they get those 2 vehicles. If there are 8 municipalities that want those vehicles, then the 2 that got them prior has to stand in line for the first 6 to pass. That's all.
Okay, we'll get it. So that's your interpretation. So even the very next RFP,
absolutely.
If
there are some municipalities that are constantly looking for
right,
vehicles,
constant,
and so there are others that have no interest.
Okay, so as long as you have more buses than municipalities
than
come
takers.
In, the very next lottery,
yes.
The same person comes.
Yes.
Okay, well, that's the interpretation of had the option to participate.
Right.
I'll accept that. Just I don't know if it's clear enough. That's certainly your interpretation.
Well, that's what I would interpret since it's
right.
Delegated. You mean the interpretation.
Well, that's why I would delegate the whole thing to you. But I guess
we knew
that
we knew what we were doing.
Yeah. Okay. I mean, that's the one.
Yeah.
We got on the record. Clarify that.
Sure.
Otherwise, I think Pete's done a very good job of moving this thing through, and it's something that the municipalities have been looking for over the years, and we should do it. It's just a question of the mechanism of doing it, but that's fine. Thank you.
Brett.
I'm happy with it.
Ms. Williams.
Fine with me.
Wow. Never thought we'd get to this point. Wrap up, Mr. Harkin.
Just a quick point, if I may, I think to Legislator Rogowski's question, I think we had to change the law in order to empower the commissioner to do these things.
No, I think we would have to amend the law, but it could be done in a more general way, amending the law to give the commissioner, to authorize the commissioner, to promulgate regulations, to do all this. But, as I say,
Yeah, it's cleaner to spell out in the legislation so that we have some parameter.
Everybody
with.
Can look at it
sure.
And see instead of looking for the regulations.
Yes.
That's fine.
Okay, Mr. Gassi, a point. I was wrong when I said that this would go to legislation. Right. Legislation has turned it over to us. Yeah.
That's why I thought.
So we will not be bringing it to
legislation. Oh, okay, I'm sorry.
Right. Yeah, so no, I kind of thought we were on the hook to do this.
Oh, okay.
I thought we were on the hook
to do
this.
I stand corrected.
Well, then let me say, in that case.
I knew I was letting myself into something.
No, as I say, as long as the law says, we can't, in one sense, it's all laid out in the charter, everyone can see it. As I say, my background sometimes, sometimes we want to do something authorized, we need to put the authority in the law, but without getting down into the details, like the next RFP and how the
sure.
delegate
and,
that to commissioners.
And every vehicle that we give away of interest will be done through A&C, so there'll be an actual agreement with the municipality, which... Clearly, the chairman's one of the public, so you'll see it as a matter of public record, so that people can track who got the last vehicle.
Mr. Chairman, the real reason for doing that is to avoid going through the process of doing this, but since law has already done it and drafted it all and it's all out there, then, we can certainly move forward as is. I don't have a major problem with it.
Okay, we've subsequently been joined by Legislator Williams and now by Legislator Myers. Ms. Myers, you want to take a bite of the dollar transfer vehicles, or should you want to pass at this point?
I'll pass at this point.
Thank you very much. Mr. Harkin, would you now like to wrap up?
I would like to wrap up. I would like to wrap up by thanking George and John and Tammy. It's been and everyone on the committee. It's been a collaborative, cooperative process, and I think this will do what we want it to do. So with that, I would move this out for all purposes.
May I have a second?
Second.
Moved by Legislator Harkin, second by Legislator Rogowski. Any comments last minute by members of the committee? If not, I'll call for a vote. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
And those opposed? Motion carries. This will now go directly to the Board of Legislators, first for a public hearing, and then subsequently for a vote. I want to thank Tammy Altshuler very much for doing this work. It's been terrific. It's great to work with you. And Commissioner Hsu, as always, we got to do this again. It's just so much fun. Thank you very much.
Take care.
Thank you. Good to see you.
All right. That was quick.
This is quick, too.
Now
I let you off easy today, Mr. Chairman.
Say again?
I let you off easy today. I'll be right back.
Okay. Well, we'll keep one going. Okay, item two is in the matter of universal design, legislation introduced by Legislator Spreckman and myself. Let's see who we've got here. For purposes of, we would want the commissioner, bring the person to Lorman Drummond, I guess. Tom Gardner is our attorney. Mr. Oros, are you joining us? Oh, is Commissioner Burroughs is here? Oh, good. That's what happens. Sitting immediately behind the blonde and the white hair just becomes invisible. John, if you please join us. Ed. So, now you go. As this is a matter that is before both the Generations Cultural and Economic Diversity Committee as well as the Housing Planning and Opportunities Committee, we are therefore going to be hearing from Legislator Spreckman to convene the committee.
Okay. I call to order the Committee on Generational, Cultural, and Ethnic Diversity, and we have a quorum. I just want to say I'm very happy that this day arrived. It was last year when we went to the meeting that you had, May, at the County Center, and we had people speak on universal design, and it was very, very interesting, and I brought it to my committee. On my committee, over the last 17 years, I really have been with Lois Bronze from Housing and my committee. Bill Burton was on that committee with me. Jose was on that committee. You took Lois's place. So both committees have almost the same people, and very happy to have Judy and Pete and Marty join. It's a long time coming. I think it's a great idea on universal design. This committee has had several meetings. I want to thank Stuart for all the help and his ideas and his knowledge. And I would hope that we pass this with a couple of changes that we agree on, because I want it done. And I really feel that it'll help. And all my life, while I've been here, I've been working with senior citizens, with May, with disabled people on my committee, trying my best to help them. And this would be a first in New York State for a county to do something like this. And it's a start. I'm not saying that it's perfect, but it's a start, and I just want everybody, okay, if you take the bill with you now that we have, I want to just, and on, would you see the Schedule A of the AARP draft legislation? Is there pages over here?
Well, the legislation is different than the draft. What we have here is this legislation. But go ahead, say what you're
okay.
Members should see that there is a committee report, the first line of which reads, an act that required to the extent feasible. So you can pick that out of your packet. Sounds feasible, that's the one.
Okay. Anyway, on this draft, where it says requirements, I would like there to say at least 15% should be approved whenever they're building, because we all know that we have, let's say, the stipulation that we have. I have my papers here. Anyway, they say that you have to have at least 125 family units before you can have senior citizen housing. That's a requirement. That's what they ask, okay? Now, family housing is children. And some of the things that we're putting in for seniors and handicapped people might work the opposite way on families with children, like the Knobs, where the kids could just, you know, we want seniors and handicapped people to be able to get easily to them, but it may affect. So that's where I got an idea of 15%, which is negotiable, which would probably be for one bedroom units, okay? Because that would be for the elderly people. People with families usually have two, you know, or more. And I think that we could be able to really afford it and get it done. If you ask for everything to be, you know, for everybody, it's going to come to lots of money. I want to do it, okay? So I'm willing to work with anybody. I mean, I am a Republican, but I care about people. I had this committee for a long time. I have worked very hard for senior citizens. And so has everybody else that has been on my committee, and housing. I voted for every housing project that there was, and I want to do the right thing, and I want this committee to be able to say that we did something in Westchester County, that we started something, and it's really good. It's good for everybody, and maybe other counties will take heed of what we did and do the same thing, so that we can help more and more and more people, okay? That is my main interest, that is my main purpose, okay? We really haven't talked about a percentage when we did it, but I'm being practical, realistic. Let's get something done, and this way, when we have the stipulation in the DSED case, we'll be able to get this done, at least if you tell them on the one bedroom apartments for seniors, you know, because they want you, everybody in Westchester, if you tell them housing, they'll say, oh, we want senior citizen housing. Okay, that's what they're interested in, and we're interested now in getting families to move all over the county. So they have children, and we have to work together. So that's where I came up with a percentage. Would anybody else like to?
Well, I think what I'd like to do actually is ask Commissioner Burrows if he would walk us through the view that he has developed on this legislation. So we'll see that many of the points that you've raised in your statement, I think, have been met. But there are a couple of matters that I think we are going to have to discuss. So if you all at the edge of the table could identify yourselves for the record and for television, I'd appreciate that, Commissioner Burrows, if you would take off. So let's begin with Mr. Orris.
George Orris, Chief of Staff.
Norma Drummond, Deputy Commissioner of Planning.
Tom Gardner, Law Department.
Ed Burrows, Commissioner of Planning.
Stu Markowitz, I'm a local architect.
Jim Castro-Blythe, Law Department.
Thank you very much. Commissioner Burrows, if you could walk us through, since you've been worked very hard with Mr. Gardner and our staff to bring this to the point where we are. Will Stoner from AARP is not here. He has also put an enormous amount of work into this. But I think we've got it to the point where we now have something that's workable, and I want to see if what you say and the way you explain it is going to be satisfactory to legislative record. So you could charge ahead.
The draft in front of you is not really what I think we should be moving ahead on. There's a couple provisions. What the chair talked about, a percentage is something we had talked about, that's not in here, but ideally, we would really like to see that, because that would be the most efficient way of moving forward as far as we're concerned. The other issue that I think isn't really clarified in here yet is the flexibility for types of units. And we talked about the last meeting and I think the AARP representative also said there are certain types of units where it does not make sense to have these requirements, particularly the walk-up units where the entrance is on the street level and there's only a staircase going up into the units. And to just leave that, when the draft will be saying there's a provision for exemptions, is kind of setting up, we think, is a process that could be questioned by anybody. And what's the basis for those questions are. If we know there's an entire type of unit that you build that shouldn't be included, I'd prefer that be clarified in the law up front, because otherwise it's going to be exempted time and time again against, you know.
Could you point us to the point in the legislation where this is?
Well, it
should be.
Is paragraph, I think it's E, accessible habitable space. As that stands, it basically makes no sense. It says every housing unit should have one habitable interior space.
No, I'm sorry. You're saying paragraph E.
I think we're looking.
You might have a different draft.
They don't have them that say draft on them.
That's a different. I think you have a different draft.
Which draft do you guys have? This is the one that was sent by law on Friday.
This is
the one that went
to C. I think C says.
Well, I don't have anything.
Accessible interior doors and doors.
In my package, I don't have anything that is overprinted with draft.
Me neither.
Depends how it's printed out.
Huh?
One came out last night.
Oh, well, that's a different one. I haven't seen that one. I only saw the one from Friday.
I didn't put the draft up here. It's embedded in it somehow.
All right, so.
Okay, I think what the members of the committee are working with is an Act number blank 2011, which has on front of it a one two-sided committee report, the first line of which
says revision 3-621-11.
Where are we seeing that?
Is that the latest one?
Upper right-hand corner.
It's very faint on the very front.
Upper right-hand.
Okay. Members, look at the Act itself in very faint lettering. It
and
says Rev 3-6/21. Okay? Yes, you've got that there. And Mr. Orris, do you have that as well now?
Yeah, okay. Do you have a copy so I can make copies for the legislators? Because we don't have that.
Well, which is the more recent one, this one or that one?
621.
If this was sent last night, we don't have it.
Oh, that went last night?
This is, no, this is what law department sent up Friday.
What should be working on this draft that we submitted, 440 on Friday.
Yeah, that's the one they have. You're saying this, is that the newest one? Okay, it's the same one.
I saw the one.
Who's on first?
All right, let's begin.
I may be able to clarify, Mr. Burton. I think that the commissioner is working off a draft that he has been working on himself, having received on Friday the same draft that the committee members received from Mr. Gardner. So I think he has made notes on his, and that's probably where there is some disconnection. The law department has not completed or sent up another draft since the one that was done on Friday. Since Friday's draft was sent, Tom has had the opportunity to meet with the members of the planning department and is in the process now of incorporating their comments into whatever we're going to be doing going forward. But there's not a separate draft that's been made since we submitted the one on Friday.
Right. The document that we have that says Rev 3621 is the basic document at this point on which Commissioner Burrows has made comments and additions.
But on his own copy.
On his own copy.
Yes.
But has not been worked through law, and is not, and you're not prepared at this point to submit this to the committee? Is that what I'm hearing?
Well, there's no second draft that has been made. Commissioner Burrows has made some notes on his own that he brought with him to the meeting with the law department. We've started discussing it, but there's been sort of back and forth on that at this point. We know the committee is working off the draft on Friday, so rather than send up something at the last minute, it makes sense, I think, for us to look at the draft that was sent on Friday, and Commissioner Burrows can then bring to the committee's attention the issues that he's identified based upon the draft the committee received on Friday.
Well, we've made a great effort to get the Generations Committee here today because I believe that we had all of this conversation that was going to be reflected in the submission that was going to be provided to us today. I take it that's not the case. And it's difficult. This is a short document. And while I recognize that Mr. Gardner is not a legislative draftsman, and he has kindly been shoved into this process, and I thank him for all the work that he's put into it. But nevertheless, we've got to get this thing focused and get it done. I'm really unhappy about this because I think that the people have been brought here again and again to answer in good faith to get answers and see if we can come to a consensus. And now to hear that we don't even have a document over which we can exchange views makes it very difficult for us.
I think, Mr. Chairman, we can express our views based on the document you have.
Yeah. On the Rev 3621
document? Yeah, I think that's it. Yeah, we can.
All right. Then in that case, while we're certainly not going to have something coming out of this that's going to be a consensus with the administration, I think we can certainly have the views of the administration and particularly Commissioner Burrows. So if you could go ahead on that basis. But please, let's get this. The summer season, the crazy season is coming on us. Today's the 21st of June. Getting us to try to get here even next week is going to be tough. People are away. School is out. We have two committees which we have to pull together. So let's please get this work done today so we can clear this up and have it ready next week. Is that satisfactory to everybody? Okay. In which case, Mr. Burris.
I was pointing out paragraph C, which is accessible habitable space.
Oh, yeah.
Starting with a good attempt to try and address the comments we made at the last meeting. But by revising it's incomplete. And if you read that, it basically says every housing unit has to have a habitable space, and that's all it says. So what we're trying to get at.
Where is that? If we go, all right, so you have no particular problem with page one. I'm just trying to work my way.
I was giving an example of a specific thing that we need to address. In subsection C, the way it's written now, it really doesn't provide any guidance at all. And it basically says every living space has to have a living space. What we're trying to get to was to distinguish a certain type of unit where these were not required. And that's what we talked about last meeting, which would be essentially units that are either entered from above or below to get to living space. And the only way to get to it is through a staircase, essentially. And in that sense, it made no sense. The previous versions had, even in those units, there had to be a habitable space on the ground level. And we're saying we build units that don't have that. And if you've indulged, we could show you some pictures of some of the projects we have done where this, where the case, we're having full access and habitable space on the ground level would be additional cost, additional floor area. The cost here is not the making units accessible or visitable. It's really the square foot that would be added to the footprint. And that's what the real building cost means. The indulgence, you want to show you a couple of projects?
I brought with me a couple boards of projects that you've seen in the past. These are ones that we've done. And so we just pulled these out of our pile just to be able to bring it on. This is right in Lake Street, Horton's Mill. All right, you'll all remember the Pettinici property that we did 17 townhouses on. I gave you this as an example because you can see clearly how on the first floor you have a garage and there's a door, but literally you get inside that door and all that rest that's on this first floor, this entrance floor, is the mechanical room and storage associated with the garage. There's no living space on this first floor. So this is really to give you an example. The living space starts on that second floor. So yes, you know, and you can see again the grades that we're dealing with. There's retaining walls in here for each of these developments. You can just pass them around if you'd like. Or we can just have examples here. This is another example where we have two units here. We have a downstairs unit and we have upstairs units. Again, that getting into this first unit, you know, with all the stairs that are required, it's just a means of getting you to remembering some of the conditions that we have to deal with. To be able to, some of the sites that we're dealing with their units. This one, again, I'm showing you because you can see the slope that we're dealing with. There's already 4-foot retaining walls on the side here. In many municipalities, for us to go above 4-foot retaining walls requires extra expense associated with engineering. So while the entrance is fairly accessible, there are still two steps here. We still are dealing with the issue of the garage and the first floor with not a whole lot of living space there.
Can I address this point real quick?
Yeah, Mr. Hart.
To this point, thank you. I know we've discussed this before.
Yeah.
We've seen the pictures before. Last page, it talks about those exemptions, and it says, for the purpose of this section, good cause shall include, but not be limited to, the unsuitability of topographical or design features. Wouldn't that address exactly what you're talking. I think we all agree with you. I just think that maybe the language is in there already.
I would prefer, as the one who's supposed to give these exemptions, to have it defined in the law that there are all categories of things exempt as of right.
Right.
To know we build these units and to have everybody come in and ask for exemption is to me kind of undermine the whole exemption process because I've had very difficulty administering it.
There was some concern too that it opens the door to litigation. It can stall an affordable housing project from going forward. If somebody, if the commissioner grants an exemption or doesn't grant an exemption, somebody comes forward and says, well, wait a minute, I think you have to do this one or you don't have to do this one. So that was the reason for trying to spell it out rather than giving
So your preference is that it be spelled out,
yes.
That we have a listing of half a dozen broad categories that would exempt a particular unit.
I'll give you, these are my notes, just to give you an example. I'm not saying I'm not the draftsman here necessarily. There'd be a paragraph that says units entered above or below living levels. The units where all habitable space is located above or below the entrance level, and habitable levels are accessible only by a stairway, there should be no requirement to provide an accessible habitable space on the dwelling unit entrance level. I think that captures a lot of these. If you don't have any habitable space, your only way is to get the staircase to get to your living floors, then we prefer not to have a requirement that you have to have habitable space on that entrance level.
Mr. Markowitz, you've been our advisory expert on these matters along with Mr. Stoner. Is that a coherent explanation of what is the reality?
Yeah, I think it is. I think that's been the question all along. And I think last week when we talked with during the meeting and then after with Will, I think he understood about there are certain building types where those they just don't have habitable space on the entry level, I think the only other thing we talked about doing was possibly leaving enough space at the landing for the future installation of a lift, if that might be added.
But otherwise, the formulation that Commissioner Burrows has just given seems to you to make sense, and both descriptively in terms of a text and also in terms of the reality that we're dealing with.
Yeah, I think
knowing what we have here at Westchester for land.
Yes, we want to do what we can to get to the entry door, but where there are unit types, whether it's a two family or a walk up, that we don't require habitable space or bathrooms or kitchens on an entry level when they're not, when the plan is that they're not supposed to be there.
Mr. Stoner, does this sound sensible to you?
Yeah, and it sounds like the language we sent around on Thursday or Friday.
That's what I thought too. Mm-hmm. Yes. Yeah. Okay.
Mr. Chairman?
Mr. Regal.
Just at this point, it seems that, because you told me, especially comes up, I saw the picture of a two-family house, one could, depending on how this legislation comes out, you have a two-family house, it could be designed potentially two, side by side, one on top of the other. And I gather if it's one on top of the other, now you're into the situation, as you're saying, that second unit is upstairs and you have a problem, whether it then would draw, if we, depending on how we drafted this, it would drive the design, no, not one on top of the other, but side by side. Then you have the whole site and land and availability. So, I mean, I think there are intended or unintended consequences in what the commissioner is saying. If our intent is that if it's one design, something with the second unit on the second floor, let's just define that it's out. No one has to come and ask that come under the exemptions if it is what it is. But you draft something, it can be a problem. But I'm seeing that picture, second unit upstairs, you're saying should just be not included in the legislation or specifically called not. Everything's there, come ask for an exemption. That you're telling us right off the top, exempted. Would that drive, does it make sense? Wherever possible, put two families side by side and then you're back under this? I mean, how does that, what would drive that decision to go side by side versus up and down?
The other issue with the side by side is if they're two-story units, you're going to have staircases. If you have a top and bottom, you have one lower level unit, it will have no staircases to be fully accessible. So I think that's...
Right, okay, well, that's a good point. So, again, you get into these... unintended consequences.
You may have a ramp to go down to get in, but then ultimately because of drainage and everything else, you can't just have the door right there. So
you're suggesting if one were to build a two-family unit with a second unit on the second floor, that should be taken out of this legislation?
Yes. And not have to go through the exemption
process.
Mr. Stoner.
That's opposite of what we discussed last Thursday or last Tuesday. Last Tuesday, we even Stu agreed that if we build an upper and lower and the bottom is accessible, you just need an exception in section D and E that says you don't need a habitable space for the stairwell and a bathroom for the stairwell. But the upstairs will have the same footprint as the downstairs, and it was completely feasible to create the same accessibility. So that if someone at some point had to put in the chairlift, their home would still be accessible. So not a full exemption, an exemption within D&E, which we wrote and passed around on Thursday, that actually allowed for those exemptions for that type of dwelling where there's a stairwell that when you walk in, all there is a stairwell. We recognize that you can't have a bathroom with a stairwell or a living space with a stairwell. So we wrote those exemptions right into the section of the law, and we felt that was the way to do it to make most sense, because then every other dwelling, no matter what kind of dwelling, would have the accessibility that we've been discussing for 6 or 8 months, even upstairs, downstairs, with the exemptions in the sections of the law. And it was that easy. It was clean, and it was cleaner. That way, we could get more of the universe of accessible housing into universal design. And not create full exemptions for second floor.
There's no argument there. I mean, I was talking about specifically the exemption to having habitable space on the entry level floor.
Yeah.
The other ones, I mean, we do have some issues with some of the other ones too, but that's a separate issue. I mean, it's not exempting them from everything across the board. That wasn't the intent. Was really
so it should say in sections D and E that it should be written. Right, and I think that language was very similar to what we were thinking. Write it right into the sections
we're
of the law.
We're memorializing this conversation in the sense that we're making notes here, because I thought we'd done that last week, and we clearly didn't. So let's, if we've got consensus on this, let's move on to the second point.
We're not the architects. There is a concern about, and we've had these discussions too, about making sure units are still family friendly and where there's a conflict with universal design. And I do not have the ability to distinguish that across the board because I can't read all the regulations as Stuart can. But there is a concern that we don't get in a position where we're building units that are not family friendly. And that's why I keep coming back to the percentage requirement, because it seems to make it much easier that way, that there's some that will always meet all these requirements and others that may not. But I'm not the expert to be able to say yes or no, but there is a concern that I think we talked about before that some of these may not be family friendly and we're supposed to be looking at family units.
And can you explain why you envision that we would be building certain units that would never be family friendly?
Well, the concern is that when we talk about accessible bathrooms, there's a concern. Number one, it says when there is a tub and a shower. Well, our affordable housing units don't have the luxury of having both of them. Okay, and realistically then to get when you're talking about accessibility, realistically you're usually talking about a shower. What happens if it's a one bedroom apartment and you have a mom and a daughter that's living there? She doesn't have a bathtub for her child to be able to take a bath. That's what we're saying, that it's not there's some issues here that are not necessarily family friendly. There may be only one bathroom in these units. All right, two bedroom units may still only have one bathroom. And so when you're talking about the requirement that at least one bathroom has to have full accessibility, it raises some concerns. Mm-hmm. That's just one example. Obviously, Legislator Spreckman already spoke about the knobs being on the front of the stove.
Right.
Okay, again, in the family-friendly sense, you've got to be careful that the children shouldn't be able to reach them. You're supposed to have the knobs at the top of the stove. You know, there's light switches or controls that are now going to be at a much more interesting level for the children, okay, especially for young toddlers. Those are the things that we have to be concerned about, that yes, you may only have one child in a one-bedroom unit, but you still have to be sensitive to the fact that there potentially could be families with children in these units.
Is there a way of classifying these kinds of problems and dealing with this, or is this simply insoluble? Stu. Sorry to put you on the spot, but you're the go-to guy.
Well, it is, obviously it's a question of what design decisions get made, not just by the architects, but by the sponsors and owners of these projects. You can design accessible bathrooms with a tub, and you know, that's something that in a family unit you'd probably prefer. As far as the heights of, I'm not sure there is any good solution for the knobs on the front of an appliance, but probably 44 inches for the height of a thermostat is probably not going to be terribly dangerous, and I don't think that raising the receptacle from 12 to 18 is also creates a big problem. It does put it more at the eye level of kids, I suppose. But I know we put plugs in ours when our kids were small. The layout issues, though, I think probably can be addressed. And I think that if the notion is that once we get a person who's mobility impaired to the second floor or the lower floor of a unit, and that layout can be adapted to their needs, I think that's something, again, I said last time, is probably not a great cost and can reasonably be done.
Thank you.
The question about tubs, again, I think that there are examples in my clients' buildings where when we retrofit buildings, especially in seniors, we retrofit the showers. but in family units, that doesn't really happen very much. I think, you know, the goal for when you do family units, you know, might be to use tubs, and that might be a guideline that you really discuss with the, you know, with the sponsors and architects that come in. But there's no prohibition of using tubs.
Mm-hmm. Legislator Rogowski, you have a comment.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think this issue has come up. An issue has come up several times, and Chairman Spreckman did it again today, and I've talked about it, and others have. Maybe we need to address this up front, and it might solve somebody's design issues trying to back it, and that comes back to percentages, as Chairman Spreckman did today, because we may not agree to it, we may come to a conclusion 100%, but I think the threshold policy question, I think it's an important one. Do we want to say only a percentage, whether it's 90% or 20%, is accessible? Because if we can make that decision, then the issues of family friendly or the things we can now, you know, to your question, is it insoluble or not? Well, at least this is one way of solving it.
Right.
Solve the percentage issue if we have one, and then everything else kind of flow into place. So rather than trying to, you know, jam things through, we're going to have to address it sooner or later. Chairman Spreckman raised it today. It's been raised in past meetings. Let's just put the policy issue on the table, get some understanding, because if we solve that, then I think, so that's just a suggestion to kind of rearrange it.
Well, first off, there's no language about the knobs on the stoves. I know that was part of a conversation probably 2 months ago about different types of accessibility of the units. That's one. Number two is it's called universal design for a reason. It's not designed just for people with mobility concerns or vision impairments or some other problem. These are family friendly. I know I'm not the only one that pushes my two-year-old daughter directly into the house and maneuver around in the baby carriage. It aids a mother or father pushing their child into the house, bringing groceries into the house, whatever. That's why it's called universal design, and that's why we've come to somewhat of an agreement that these minimum standards are the minimums that are necessary to help a family to live with accessibility throughout the span that they're in that home. So there's nothing in here that precludes a family from being in there. I do have a question for Stu, if I may. What is the difference in footprint between a full bathroom and a full accessible bathroom? How much more space does that really require?
Well, I think we talked about historically, you know, the old in-city, you know, bathrooms, you know, were 5x7. And so it's 35 square feet. And I think that when we do a type B, you know, a type B installation, which is the lesser requirement, but it's the more universal requirement in the code today, you probably get to about 50 square feet. So it's that level of.
But that's ADA requirement type B?
Not ADA, fair housing.
Okay.
Fair housing and ANSI type B.
Okay.
In other words, if you have a building, all one bedroom apartments, all one bath, they would be, at a minimum, they'd all have to be designed to type B. If you had units that had two bathrooms, you could do them all type B, or you could do one non-compliant and one type A. And then the type A would have a larger footprint with a 5-foot turning circle. The type B don't require that, and they're much more typical of what you see in most housing today. Probably getting towards 60 or so.
So what this legislation 62. Calls for is 50? Or what does this call for our accessible bathroom language? What size is that?
Well, when I sketched it, I was talking about type Bs.
Okay, so about 50. So yeah. 15 more square feet to have a full accessible bathroom. Okay. And nothing precludes the builder from putting in a bathtub. Because it says bathtub or shower.
Right. That's
and
right.
If it's the only bathroom, usually it's the shower with a tub. Usually.
With a tub.
If it's a full bathroom.
Yes, if it's got a tub. Right.
So we're talking about 15 square feet.
Oh,
Evan Latainer is here from the county office for the disabled, and he was kind enough to tell me that he had to leave at 2:30, and I said, well, we'll get something in here from him. But could you, at this point, just give us the benefit of your thinking about where we should be driving this process? I think we have an issue here of whether or not we're going to be able to write this such that it will cover everything, or whether we're going to basically default to what Legislator Spackler has had, which is a percentage driven. It's a kind of a, it's not a half a loaf or no loaf question, but it does have something of that effect.
I think that the language is key on what you're talking about. And I think that you have to look at specifically accessibility. If you're talking about two apartments or houses on top of each other versus side by side, I think you have to come up with a clear answer on what you want. I see pros and cons to both, and it's a hard decision. But I also think that the percentages, 15%, 20%, whatever you look, I always look for as much as you can get. I said that last time I was here, but I understand being realistic that you have to have a specific number. The bathroom piece, what you were just talking about, the 50 feet was correct?
Yeah, 50%.
You need to look at turnarounds. You also need to think about what you were saying, if it's going to be one bathroom in that house, if it's going to be universal, family friendly, you need to have a bathtub in there as well. So I think those are the avenues that you got to go. And you have to, the language is the key piece here, it's my opinion. What you're writing at, what you're going to say.
But you do not inherently have an objection if we were to come to a decision to go with a percentage. If that would not create an insurmountable problem from your point of view of your clientele?
No.
Thank you. Mr. Stone.
I guess, I'm not an expert in percentages and exemptions, but, let's say it's 80%. Now, you're going to have exemptions within that 80%, so now that 80% is going to be whittled down to what number? But if you start at 100%, or close to, or you put it in the law that says these are the provisions, and you have to ask for an exemption, that is the normal approach for these types of laws that have passed in other municipalities and in other language that has been written for trust housing trust funds, etc., that you have to ask for an exemption. Recognizing that it might be some sort of burden if it's not spelled out. I think it's cleaner if you just say, these are the regulations, when they apply to build the affordable housing. If they cannot meet because of one of six criteria, that's understood, and they just have to explain why they can't meet that criteria to build it fully accessible, and that's acceptable. But if you say 80%, it's an arbitrary number. Or 75%, and then that number could easily be whittled down to 40, 45, 50. We don't know.
Well, I think that's why I personally have been trying to drive this in the direction of coming to a conclusion that would not put us into a percentage game. But what I'm seeing is that everybody at this table is here to solve a problem. I don't think, and I'm loath to say this because we are in a political world, but I don't think there is any deliberate foot dragging by any participant in this process. We're trying to come to something that's going to get us a law. Legislator Spreckman and I are really focused on getting something done. So if we have to do this, if we have to set up a structure, which given the weirdness of the way Westchester works in terms of its land and everything else, we may wind up having to do this. I'm with you. I don't want to be doing a percentage for percentage, which ultimately winds up being some ludicrously low number. But I do take your point, that and I'm on that side, but I'm not altogether sure we're going to be able to avoid that.
Okay.
So, Ms. Spreckman, and then Ms. Roers.
You came in, late when I started this. You know that you were at that meeting that we had where this whole thing started, when May and I had that meeting. You came to the, and Bill, I asked Bill to put it in the housing committee. I had it in my committee. I worked hard. All I want you to know from the bottom of my heart is I want a law. I want it, okay? And if it means compromising and doing things, Otherwise, you're going to drag this on and on and on. And when you deal with the federal government, okay, and I just feel that we have to do something that everybody will be happy about, okay? And I think that you need a percentage because of a lot, okay, potentially, requiring more than, let's say 15%, let's say 20%, potentially adds additional cost to build fair and affordable housing settlement. Universal design drives up the cost of each unit, and the county is not allowed to provide funding to offset the added design and constructional cost. We got to take that into consideration. Under current law, the county may only assist in land acquisition, or which is the NHLA fund or the Public Infrastructure HIF fund. It creates an unfunded and long-term compliance burden on county planning department staff. It may deter families from purchasing these units. Universal design locates, which I said, the knobs or any other thing that they're saying right away, you have to build 125 units family. They're not interested in senior citizen or handicap right now. They really want you to go right into family style. So let's say the percentage we're talking about to do the things we want to do would be for seniors and handicapped people, okay, rather than family style. I just want to be able to do something, and I don't want it to drag on forever and ever and ever. So if we have to do percentages for the one-bedroom apartments and leave the two-bedroom alone, however we get it, that would be my part, just in order to be able to do something and say, you know, Westchester came up with a law. It's the beginning. It's not the end. Let's try to do something and move. I don't want to come back next week and the week after and the week after, and then this one's on vacation, that one's on vacation. It's Labor Day. Then it's Christmas, okay? And we got nothing done. We got to work together to get it done. Huh? I wanted to get him to be able to say he did it, okay? And him. Both hims.
Mr. Orris.
Well, actually, Legislator Sprechman took some of my thunder, because I think one of the things you have to keep sight of here and why the percentages may help is that we are under this settlement order. And, you know, every dollar that we don't, that adds to the cost of building any of that housing means that's less units that we'll be able to get to achieve the mandate that we've been given by that settlement. Two other minor things. And this is something I raised to the planning department, and I'm not sure how this works. When the planning department gets one of these projects, they don't get really full design plans necessarily, right? You don't get the full architectural drawings.
We do for exterior improvement,
right,
site work, because we have to
but not for the
building department and the local municipality reviews.
Right. So we have to make sure there's a mechanism somewhere, because once we hand that off, if they go into the building, even if they showed us the interior, and then he goes to the building inspector and says, you know what, I realize I can't do this because it's going to cost too much money, and now I want to shrink this one and do this and do that, we don't really have any say in that. That's between the developer and the municipality. And there's no, and I don't know that we want one, there's no enforcement mechanism here. If we give money to a developer who says, I'm going to build 15 units that are going to be UD, and it turns out only 14 are built, can we get our money back? I don't know. It's just the way this county is, where the locals have control over something, yet we're putting it out. So I don't know if it's something that ever came up in any of the deliberations before. I think I might have brought it up in one of the first deliberations, but it may be a ministry point, not even worth considering. But there's a second thing, too.
Please.
We want to make sure that whatever we do here doesn't be looked upon by the federal monitor as an impediment to furthering fair and affordable housing. And again, if you're adding things under a county law that's driving up the cost of building that, it's possible that we could be creating our own impediment when we're supposed to be working on an analysis of impediments and removing those impediments.
I think that's a fair point. Well, we have a committee that will be meeting here at 3 o'clock, and we have to give time. I also have to be in a meeting separately at 3 o'clock. So, Mr. Harkin, your comments, and then if we can get Ed to sum up his concerns so that we can bring this forward. I know.
No, her hand was up first. I yield.
Okay, Ms. Sheffield.
Oh, thank you very much. I just wanted to say something about on the issue of percentages on behalf of people with disabilities, because many of us do have families. There are many children who are disabled. There are many of us who have older people in our households who may become disabled later. And so to exempt all units but one bedroom units, which may or may not be created specifically for seniors, which no longer allow younger people who are physically disabled in them, so that won't cover people to do it that way, to just have a percentage for specifically senior housing. I think that fair and affordable housing, fair housing also does include making sure people with disabilities have housing, and your con plans and things I've read in the past, it's always cited the lack of affordable and accessible housing as a major barrier to fair and affordable housing in Westchester County and throughout New York State. And so I just, I think a lot of these things probably can be ironed out, but some of, the concerns that are being raised are not things that are going to hurt families or children, but if you don't create them accessible, is going to only compound the housing crisis for people with physical disabilities in Westchester County, which there is. There are very few affordable and accessible houses, and to modify it later is a major barrier as well. So the last three apartments I was sitting here thinking, the last three apartments I've lived in have the knobs in the front of the stove. I mean, I think that's a normal thing. I don't even know if it's in the bill. I haven't seen it. But some of these things that are being raised are kind of in, housing anyway. They're kind of standard. So I just ask everybody to keep that in mind as we're talking about percentages and where they should go or not go, or, some of these barriers.
Mr. Hart.
That pretty well sums up what I was going to say. What we're talking about is universal and life cycle housing from the family with the toddler and the stroller to people with disabled parents, to people who are disabled, to people with disabled children, to people who move in and may become disabled. I don't think anything we're talking about is precluding families. I think this is furthering fair and affordable housing. The example of the topography, clear example of where we should have an exemption. I think, I don't think we should be going with percentages, because I think what we're talking about is universal design, not 50% design. But I think what we can do is let's have a concise, succinct conversation. What are the real issues that where a waiver could be needed, and to the commissioner's point, let's get him in the law so he's not stuck in the hot seat. He's not, and the county, we're not open for liability. Things like topography, if there are a couple other things, let's get him in the table. Let's see if we can get him in the law, and that would be my position.
Well, okay, Stu, but I want to get to Mr. Burrows because we've only got 15 minutes left.
I want to
get all these out on the table so that everybody's in a position to be able to write this into a version which we're going to have in front of us this time next week.
I agree. I agree with Mr. Harkin. I do want to make a couple of points. One is that some notes that I put forward last week really tried to simplify the direction in the Act and refer to the technical standards that were in ANSI, currently enforced ANSI of 2003. And that way the definitions and standards and dimensions that are outlined there, with their exceptions, were incorporated simply by saying we're going to follow those rules. That way we, when we talk about an accessible entrance, or we talk about, a type B bathroom or a type B kitchen, there are rules for that. I think that the points about the about units that traditionally do not have habitable space on the first floor, I think we really have to, you know, we really have to incorporate that, because it too many sites, in, certainly in our area, are such that land is at a premium. It's costly, and it's the only way to really get affordable, you know, affordable designs out of some sites. I think the Fair Housing Act discusses exceptions for topography. You can use that as a guideline. And if the issue is, you know, whether a stove has knobs on the front or top, you know, that's a pretty simple accommodation ultimately. And so, you know, it's an easy switch. I guess that's really all.
Mr. Burns, we can return to you then, and finish off your comments, please. I'd appreciate it.
I think the perspective we come into this is the difficult position of balance. I mean, in one sense, what everybody's looking for from universal design is almost impossible to argue with. In the other sense, we have limited dollars and we have to get housing built in 6 years. So anything that adds a cost that we really can't justify in the sense of the housing, which is the main issue is the unit type design, requiring a habitable space on the floor that isn't part of the design. And to exempt those, that goes a long way. The other part of it, which Chief of Staff referenced to too, is the administration of this in terms of creating, I don't want to be on both sides of the issue, let's put it this way, of saying, oh, you have to do universal design, but we want to keep the cost down. And you start balancing things that way. I mean, that's putting us in a very difficult position, because then why does it cost so much for these units to subsidize this project? Well, we're doing all this, but at the same time we're saying behind our back, you know, don't do these things because you get an exemption for it. I don't want to be in that position. So that's why having a percentage to me is much cleaner, because you know you're going to get certain ones that are going to be universal design, and there's others we don't have to fight about. I don't think it'll get lower, because it's going to be, you're going to have that minimum. It'd be very hard to get an exemption. I'd be much more inclined not to get an exemption at that point, because you know going in that you have to have a certain fixed percentage that are universal design. So that's really the way I would approach it.
But does that cover the points that you have of concern with the legislation before us?
Well, the part of it too, and I'm not the lawyer here, the way this was redrafted this time, also because another point we had, is that the architects on the project would be certifying they're compliant. We don't have the capacity to do building plan design. We don't have the capacity to go review the building permit the local building inspector is giving, who, and we know building inspectors in some of our municipalities, are fairly independent. So we want to be very careful about that. The architect certifying they did it, we're not going out inspecting and checking it because we don't have that capacity, and I don't think we want to add that capacity. And we're relying on a process that may have some vagueness to it at the local level. And that's what we have to go into knowing that.
It's probably the least onerous certification I'd have to write.
Okay.
All right. Yeah, but that does it, as far as you're concerned.
And what am I missing?
Do you still need them to spell out the different exemptions, though? Because they'll still have people applying for exemptions, so you want that still written out in the law.
Yes.
So not just the sentence says...
There's an exemption process, but I think as long as you get certain unit types that we know from a fact we get an exemption because we still want to build those, that makes getting an exemption a lot harder.
All right.
And just one additional thing, Mr. Chairman. In referencing ANSI as the standard of 2003, that standard itself cross-references other standards and other legislation that has in fact evolved since 2003, and ANSI itself is also an evolving document. Now, we can sort of freeze time on the 2003, but what do we do in terms of the cross-reference statutes and what is and is not applicable for a builder who is going to be complying with those 2003 standards? That's just sort of another problem with referencing that statute and not being as complete as possible as we can be in drafting this piece of legislation.
Well, I think we discussed that before, and I think the answer was that we were going to recognize the evolution of the standards, not only of ANSI 03, but also of the cross-referenced items. And as every architect and developer is going to have to deal with those anyway, I think so long as we acknowledge that in the law, I do not recall that was going to present us with a problem. We asked May Carpenter to come today, and she's been stunningly patient. But if you would, May, would you give us the benefit of your thoughts?
Yeah, I just have a question. What percentage of those units under the judgment are supposed to be for senior housing?
no more than 25% are allowed to be for senior housing.
Okay, so that's the group that...
But seniors could live in any of them.
Right.
Just can't exclusively be senior.
Right, so when you start talking about 20% meeting unit diversity design, you're practically talking about most of the units that we have to build anyway for seniors. And you've got 51,000.
Well, we don't have to build any for seniors.
You don't have to?
No.
We don't have, we're allowed to do up to 25%, but we don't have to do any for seniors.
Well, you've got 51,000 seniors with disabilities here in this county. They make that.
I'm not saying we won't do any. I was telling you what the state says.
Welcome to housing.
Yeah, really.
Some of us that voted against that settlement were worried about that, just that point, because we only have a finite amount of resources, and to comply with the settlement, it goes to the balance. We don't have some resources left that we might want to put into that.
Well, right, leaving that particular aspect aside, Mr. Burrs, have we got this now narrowed down? Your comments are on paper. Mr. Gardner is here, and the two of you are sitting elbow to elbow. I want a document at 1:30. I want a document by the end of this week so we can circulate to everyone concerned. And then I want to hold this committee meeting, and I damn well want it to be the last meeting that we're having on this matter, next Tuesday at 1:30. Can I count on this happening, Mr. Ross? I'll bounce it up to your level.
We could draft something. I don't know how the committee will feel about it.
I fully understand that, but I want to have it so that we're not reading very light pencil marks.
Yeah, no, I think they're...
All right, and may I have it to staff by Thursday afternoon?
Yeah, I think so, because we've got the... Right?
Yes.
We have the guts of it here.
All right, then Wednesday afternoon, that would be cool.
I don't know.
Mr. Gallagher, shortly.
Mr. Oros raised the issue of enforcement, because again, given Westchester County, could I suggest... I think we've done this in other places. I mean, it's a big problem in terms of actually trying to enforce it, but it's my understanding that generally we only have a certain circle of developers that work in this area. It's not like across the way, as much as we want developers, more work in this area than not. Does it do any harm putting in the law that were a developer, because that's where the person who's making the decisions, in some way violate, at the end of the day, when it's all built and done, violate, that developer is prevented from participating in our system for a period of time. And so it's almost like a self-enforcing, just as an idea. I mean, we don't want to stop developers from doing this. I mean, but if there is a concern, because it seems like I'm trying to sit here, it's a good point. How do they just go ahead and do what they want to do, and it just vitiates everything we've done.
Well, I would expect the local building department, the town boards, and the planning department would long since
they're not necessarily going to enforce our law. They may build what they tell the local building department they're going to build. They just didn't build
we've
already bought the land and transfer title.
But that's why we have an approval process.
I just suggest if that makes any sense to say after the fact.
If you consider that in your work,
just a thought,
Commissioner, I think that'd be
right. I don't make sense.
I'd like to wrap this up, and it makes a great deal of sense that I asked Mr. Stoner to make his final comment.
Actually, I actually want to rearticulate a question to make sure going forward. There's two things that I got from Commissioner Burrows. When I said the exemptions, I didn't mean for the accessible bathroom or habitable space. I meant for the law in general. So you also want a listing of, because right now there's three criteria that are listed, and it says, but not limited to. So you want a full listing of maybe six options so that your office is aware of what those exemptions should be so that a builder does not have to comply with the law. That's what you're hoping. That would be helpful. Okay. And the last thing is, we're letting the elephant out of the room. We're not even suggesting what kind of percentage. And we're going to have them go draft a percentage, and we're leaving it up to them.
I don't know that we agreed on percentage.
Right.
So it's going to be written as something
that is acceptable to the administration coming back. If that draft says, in the administration's view of this, has a percentage in it, then we'll discuss it. The rest of us are adult enough to say we can strike that particular phrase and go in another direction, which may or may not put us in the... on the same page with the administration. But we have got to have a document that we're in agreement with, that the administration has fully expressed its understanding and support of, and then we'll go from there. That's what I want. Mr. Parker.
Mr. Chair, thank you. I just want to put on the record, since you have left the door open to the possibility of percentages for the next draft, I just want to put on the record as one legislator that I will not support anything that does not have a sizable percentage of units. I don't think we want to.
Now we're getting somewhere.
I'm serious. You know, I don't think we want to be talking about,
none
you
of
know,
us,
15% of
none
the
of
units.
Us want to do that either. And that's,
know,
why
so
we've got to get this. The elephant.
I'm speaking as one legislator. I will not support something that does not have a sizable number of the units as universal design.
I respect that and frankly support it as well. Are we done? Do we have everything out on the table? All right. Thank you, gentlemen and lady, very much.
Thanks,
smile,
everybody. Good to see you.
Very much. I have a motion on minutes for the Committee on Housing Planning and Operations.
I can move the minutes of June 1st and 17th.
He's doing it now.
I'll second that and move the minutes of April 5th.
And I'll second those. All in favor, then, for all three, say aye.
Aye.
Okay, motion carries.
Motion to adjourn
is in order. So moved. So moved. Yes, you say second.
Oh, I'm not lucky. Don't trick me like that.
Second. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
We are adjourning both committees. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Thank you. We are adjourned. Thank you.
Take care, everybody. Good to see you,
Ed. Mr. Chairman, I don't want to break your heart, but I'm not going to be here next Tuesday.
Bye, George. Bye, Norma.
Bye.
Good to see you. Good to see you, Bill. Welcome back.
Welcome back.
Take care, everyone.
I was missing a few marbles there for a little bit, so. But I'm fine. The effects of the anesthesia, the anesthesiologist said right off the bat, the recovery, he does not tolerate this stuff well. I probably should have talked about oh, no, absolutely not. No, my wife will be sitting downstairs at my parking lot in space at 3:30. But, no, I won't be driving for another week and a half. Driving is the focus right now. That's about as anesthetic as you can get.
Yeah,
legislator, those comments weren't directed at you. The conversations have been going on for 6 weeks now. No, 85% that are you
allowing for an excessive
you can eliminate that. Look at our land, all this rock formation and stuff here and marshland. You don't have that much land to build on, number one. Right. What you do build on is not going to be flat land. But you know what? It's not going to be 25%.
We don't have any reservations.
We don't have any reservations.
How are you?